Morris, my esteemed debate partner. Thank you so much for agreeing to chat with me.
My pleasure.
Just flew around and you're tired, so I super appreciate the opportunity to chat with you once more. Before I dive into serious stuff, I'm curious, who, in your opinion, is the most interesting person in Israeli history, like from 1880 onwards?
Well, there's lots of interesting figures. This is probably true about the Zionist movement, though it may be true about lots of nationalist revolutions or nationalist movements. But Ben-Gurion is certainly a very interesting figure and certainly the central figure in Zionist history following Herzl.
You think he's the most interesting?
I think so, yeah. I think he's probably the most interesting character, yeah.
Okay, just curious. And all the random people I've read about, Menachem Begin?
Begin's also interesting.
Very interesting.
As I say, there's a lot of interesting characters around, yeah.
Okay, I was curious. Okay,
yeah.
That was your softball. Something that we spoke about before we did our debate, I was asking you questions back and forth, make sure I wasn't missing anything, and you kind of offhandedly mentioned something that I thought was really interesting, that Arab society tends to engage in a lot of oral history. They kind of like, they tell stories, they pass along.
It's not a matter of engaged. The Arabs do not have the Arabs in general don't have a tradition of historiography a la the West. Mm-hmm. If they started putting things down in documents, it's probably under the influence of the imperial overlords, the French and the British, who ruled over much of the Arab world in the 20th century, even slightly earlier. But they do have a strong tradition of oral, strong oral tradition, and this certainly applies to the Palestinians, who had no state, no state bureaucracies, therefore did not produce archival material. So among the Palestinians, their core historical record is oral.
Mm-hmm. One thing that you told me that is easy to compare some of the stories that you've heard to the actual archive stuff from Israel, that the stories actually tend to line up pretty well with what happened?
I'm not saying that they tend to line up, but you do. I have found interviews and oral history conforming to, corresponding to things I found in documents, more than I expected initially. So okay. In some way, even surprised me. You didn't find the detail you find in documentation. The dates are wrong. The mm-hmm. numbers are wrong. There's all sorts of things wrong, but sometimes the core story matches what you found in Israeli records about the same event.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious on a personal level. When you're a historian and you want to do research and you talk about like going to national archives, can you just like show up to these places and say, give me a copy of this? Or do you have to show you like your historian license? Or what is that process like?
In the West, most archives are open to anybody, mm-hmm. the public. The people who go normally are historians or students of history. But they basically would like to see who you are. They usually issue an ID card for you for the use in that particular archive. And from then on, you just go through catalogs of documentation and order files. That's how it works.
Do you think that having a strong interpretation of a lot of the source material, do you think that requires you to be a native speaker? Or do you think that it's okay to get stuff secondhand? Do you think there's significant differences in translation sometimes?
You should have access to and knowledge of the language in which the documents are written. Mm-hmm. So English, Hebrew, the problem with the Arabic is that the Arab world, they're all dictatorships. All Arab states are dictatorships, authoritarian states which do not open their archives, not to their own people, not to foreigners. Mm-hmm. Certainly about 1948, you won't find Egyptian, Jordanian, Syrian archives, documentation open. So in that sense, access to Arab documentation is not really of much use concerning the periods I dealt with. Whereas French, English, Hebrew are languages which are acquired if you want to study things in which Israelis, Britons, Americans, etc., mm-hmm. Frenchmen in some way participated as diplomats, as intelligence agents, as fighters, as officials, and so on.
I'm curious, I think it's accurate to say that you're most known for your history around like 48 and documenting stuff that's happened kind of like in that time period. Is there a particular archive that you would really want access to, like a question that you have about a particular battle, a particular massacre?
Archives relating to 48, to the mm-hmm. war of 48, as to in fact other wars, though they're not all open, there's a 30-year rule or a 50-year rule. The IDF archive is crucial.
Oh, I didn't even mean for Israel. I meant like if you could have access to like an Egyptian archive.
Oh, yes, I'd love to see the official Egyptian state archives, and I'd like to see the Jordanian court archive, the Jordanian Arab Legion archive, but all of these are closed. Mm-hmm.
Is there a particular, as you study, is there some question that you kind of like come close to, but you just need the final answer? Yeah.
The major question which I would hope to find answers to in Arab archives would be Arab intentions, if I'm talking about the 48 war, Arab objectives, intentions in that war. Mm-hmm. Why did the Jordanians invade? What did the brigade and battalion commanders think their military objectives or political targets were? The same applies to the Egyptian government, the Syrian government, the Iraqi government. What did they actually go to war for? This is something which is crucial to understanding the war, because mm-hmm. there's various sides in the war and their objectives are crucial. But the answers to these questions about the Arab states' intentions in these wars, or in the 48 war certainly, one has to find the answers in Israeli archives, Israeli intelligence documentation, American, British, French diplomatic documentation, etc., but not firsthand from Arabs, because the Arab archives are closed. That's the problem.
Do you think that?
So that's a certain black hole in any historiography of 48. Mm-hmm.
Do you think it'd be interesting to know those same intentions for like 56 and 67, or do you think it's more kind of because everything's more
public? No. The same would apply to 67. What was Nasser's objectives in the various steps he took before the war broke out? And on the 5th of June, 1967, what was his intentions when he sent his troops into Sinai, when he closed the Straits of Tiran, mm-hmm. in the days preceding Israel's preemptive assault on Egypt? Certainly it would be interesting. It certainly would be interesting to know King Hussein's assessments and intentions before Jordan entered the war and began shelling Jerusalem and other parts of Israel, which prompted Israel to attack East Jerusalem and the West Bank mm-hmm. on the 5th and 6th and 7th and 8th of June 467.
And the West, truly we talk about like one or two historical events because nobody really knows anything about the things they feel strongly about, but it is what it is. In the West, obviously the Nakba is the only thing I've spoken about for 48. Some people, if they know a little bit more, will mention like Plan Dalit, Plan D. Can you give a brief summary or idea of this idea that in 48, there was this 10-year plan that the Jews had always had from Plan Dalit when they started making it, that they wanted to expel every single Arab and...
This is all total nonsense. There was no plan to expel the Arabs, nothing dating back 10 years at all. Things which happened in Plan D is from March 48. It's not from 10 years back. It was the Haganah's plan to defend the Jewish state against the impending Arab invasion, which was expected the moment the British left, which was in mid-May. And the Arabs, in fact, invaded the Arab states, the armies of Jordan, Syria, Egypt, and Iraq invaded on the 15th of May. And that was expected, and the Haganah planned for it. The Jewish, main Jewish defense organization planned for it in Plan Dalit, which was signed and sealed on the 10th of March, 1948. It's well to remember, I think, when talking about 48, that 48 was a war. It wasn't... Arabs today and their propaganda and their supporters in the West who know nothing about the war itself, it's best to remember that there was a war in 1948, not just an expulsion. And the Arabs, Palestinian Arabs, began it in December 1947 by shooting at the Jews, 1947, which snowballed into a full-scale civil war between the Jewish and Arab communities in Palestine, the land of Israel. And when the Arabs, the Palestinian Arabs, lost their civil war against the Jewish community in Palestine, the Arab states invaded the day after the Jews declared statehood. On the 14th of May, the Jews declared statehood. On the 15th, the Arab states' armies invaded Palestine. In the course of that war, a lot of Arabs were uprooted from their homes and became refugees. A few of them were expelled. Most of them simply fled, but then weren't allowed back by Israel to the territory of the newborn state of Israel and the areas which they had captured in the course of the war, mm-hmm. In addition to the states' territories as designated by the UN partition resolution of November 47.
You're pretty familiar with the partition?
I've heard about it.
You've heard about it. Okay, that's good. I have as well. I have a few pretty specific questions about the partition. I'm curious. Is there any truth to the idea that when the land was offered, when that split happened, that the Jews were given all of the arable land, or that the Palestinians were ripped off, or that the Jews were given land that was only made arable by them and cultivating it through the 20s and 30s? Or
This is a complicated question.
But I understand,
Firstly, the partition proposal by the UN General Assembly from 29 November 47 allocated to the Jews 55% of the landmass, what was called Palestine, from the River Jordan to the Mediterranean, 55%. And the Arabs of Palestine were allocated something like 43% or something of that landmass. 55% the Jews were allocated was mostly desert. Over half of it, 55, 60% of it, was desert. It wasn't arable, it was really desert, and to this day remains basically a wasteland, even though there are oases there. The south of Palestine, the south of the land of Israel, is mostly desert, and that was the bulk of what was given to the Jews. It's true that the Jews in the northern areas, which were allocated for Jewish statehood, the Jezreel Valley, some of the northern coastal plain, that was highly, and part of the Jordan Valley, that was highly cultivable and arable and fertile, etc. The Arabs were given what's today called the West Bank, or an enlarged West Bank, which they lost in the 48 war, but basically the West Bank and the Gaza Strip and the southern coastal plain, which was also very arable, very fertile land. So it wasn't divided into arable and non-arable, though I suppose the coastal plain, after being developed and agriculturally by the Jews, became very fertile, whereas the hill country, which has olives and other things, but doesn't have as much vegetation and water as the coastal plain, and that was in Arab hands. But that's where the bulk of the Arab population was concentrated, in the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and the Galilee hills, the hills of Galilee. The Arabs maintained, and here there's something in what they said, that the Jews, who were represented a third of the population of Palestine, something like 650,000 people, were given 55% of the land, and the Arabs, who were two-thirds of the population of Palestine, were given only 43%. And that, they said, was a certain injustice. But this was balanced out, as I think, and as the Jews understood, by the fact that half or more than half the land the Jews were being given was wasteland, and that the land being given to the Jews, as the United Nations members understood, was destined not just for the 650,000 Jews who lived there, but for the ingathering of the exiles, Jews from abroad, survivors of the Holocaust, survivors or whatever you want to call them, from the Arab states, the Jews who lived in Arab states. So the Jews had to be given more land so they would have a place to settle them.
And I think there are 450 or 500,000 some Arabs that lived on the what would have been partition for the Jews as well, right? It was a sizable...
Yes. The area which the Jews were being offered or earmarked for Jewish statehood in the partition plan was to have something like 500,000 Jews or 550,000 Jews. Another 100,000 Jews lived in Jerusalem, which was supposed to be international territory. Mm-hmm. But 550,000 Jews lived in the territory earmarked for Jewish statehood, alongside more than 400,000 Arabs, 450,000, maybe even 490,000, depended how many Bedouins were actually there. Nobody knew the number. Sure. So it's 400,000 plus. So in fact, the proportions were probably 60% Jewish, 40% Arab, in the area designated for Jewish statehood by the United Nations partition plan. Had the Arabs accepted it, there would have been no war, there would have been no uprooting of Arabs in the course of a war, and the Jewish state would have had to manage with a very, very large Arab minority, except the Jews, in accepting the plan, believed that a lot of Jews would be pouring into the country from the survivors of the Holocaust and others, which would then increase the Jewish proportion of the population in the Jewish state.
This is like a quick question, I guess, personal curiosity, because people argue a lot about the origins of the Six-Day War, or the inciting moments, I guess. Do you think that Nasser wanted that war at that time, or do you think it was brinksmanship, that he was just speaking a lot?
He was playing brinksmanship, and I think he made a mistake. I don't think he wanted a war. I don't think he properly assessed whether his army was strong enough to fight off the Israelis. He never made a proper intelligent calculus of what he was doing. But he thought that he could get away with making political points, winning political advantage by remilitarizing the Sinai Peninsula, by blocking Israel off from the Straits of Tiran, in other words, closing Israel's southern outlet of Eilat to freedom of navigation, etc., by closing the straits. He thought he would gain these things against Israel, and Israel wouldn't respond with a war. He didn't think Israel would respond, especially after he had alliances with Jordan and Iraq and Syria. Going into the war, he thought, well, the Israelis would be deterred by such a surrounding alliance of Arab states under his control, so he felt. And he made a mistake. Israel couldn't allow the remilitarization of the Sinai Peninsula, something agreed to by the international community in Egypt in 1957 at the end of the 56 war, after the 56 war. And it couldn't agree to the loss of freedom of navigation from its southern port, which connects Israel to Asia and Africa, and the aircraft, incidentally. They also blocked off the air routes to South Africa, to Africa and Asia. Israel couldn't agree to this. And beyond that, there was, of course, the threat. Once Egyptian divisions were pushed into Sinai, which is what he did, there was the threat that they would attack Israel, these divisions. So Israel couldn't leave it the chance to maybe Nasser would attack, maybe he wouldn't attack. Israel had to move.
Yeah.
It had no choice, especially if the Egyptians massed five divisions in Sinai as they did, Israel would have to mobilize. It mobilizes. And then what do? If you deem it, your economy is shut down by the mobilization of hundreds of thousands of soldiers. And you just leave them in the desert waiting for the Egyptians to do something or not do something. It was an untenable situation which Nasser forced Israel into, forcing it to go to war.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and then also when you talk about the deployment of the military across the Sinai, that also included the expulsion of the UN.
Yes, the UN force, the UN was ejected. Sorry,
yeah.
I should have mentioned that.
Yes,
Nasser of course, called for the ejection of the UN buffer military force, which was between the Israelis and the Egyptians on the Egyptian side of the Sinai-Israel border.
Mm-hmm. Do you think, I've heard some people blame that war on the faulty Soviet Union intelligence reports that
were either faulty or deliberately misleading. Nobody knows why exactly the Soviets in the 2 weeks or so before the war broke out, 3 weeks before the war broke out, why the Soviets told the Egyptians and the Syrians that the Israelis were massing for attack against Syria.
Mm-hmm.
Syria was the client state of the Soviet Union in the region, and the Soviets saw themselves as protectors of Syria. The theory is, the belief is, among historians, that the Soviets sent this incorrect message to Egypt and to Syria, mainly to get the Egyptians to reinforce their commitment to defend Syria. In other words, they would tell the Egyptians, the Israelis, about to attack Syria. Syria is Egypt's ally. Mm-hmm. Egypt must commit to protecting Syria if the Israelis invade. And here we are showing the Egyptians telling the Egyptians the Israelis are about to attack Syria.
Mm-hmm.
Israel said this is all nonsense when they were told by the United Nations, whoever, that the Soviets are claiming that Israel is massing troops to attack Syria. Israel said to the Russian ambassador, go visit the border between Israel and Syria, see if Israel is actually mobilized and massed troops to attack Syria. The Russian ambassador declined to go. And the United Nations said there is no proof at all, no evidence that Israel is massing troops there. But this wasn't sufficient for Egypt. Egypt sent its divisions into Sinai, supposedly on the basis of belief in this misinformation by the Moscow.
Is there any truth to the idea that part of what empowered Jordan to attack or encourage them to attack through the West Bank into Israel in 67 was because Nasser lied about the planes coming back
This is certain. The Israel attacked the Egyptian troops in Sinai and Egyptian air bases in Sinai and Egypt proper on the morning of the 5th of June. the Egyptians told the Jordanians that the Egyptian Air Force, was attacking Israel's bases, yeah. and the Egyptians were busy attacking the Negev as well with ground troops. Hussein bought it, apparently he believed what the Egyptians were telling him and felt that he had no choice but to join the war, otherwise he would be considered in the street, by the Arab street, a traitor to the Arab cause. He must join an Arab assault, Egyptian assault on Israel. Mm-hmm. So he started shelling Israeli territory on the morning, about 10 o'clock on the morning of June 6, not knowing that Israel had actually attacked the Egyptians and was busy destroying the Egyptian Air Force, in fact, something which occurred within 3 hours. Mm-hmm. From 8 o'clock until 11 o'clock, there was really no Egyptian Air Force after that. But he didn't know that, so he started shelling Israel, machine gunning Israeli positions in Jerusalem and further inside Israel. And Israel told the Jordanians already at 8 o'clock, don't join the war, we will not attack you. And Israel said it again after the Jordanians started shooting, and again the Jordanians didn't pay any attention, and that resulted in Israel attacking the Jordanians in East Jerusalem and in the West Bank, and eventually conquering East Jerusalem and the West Bank and defeating the Egyptian, the Jordanian army in Jordan. Another fact which should be taken into account and apparently is important is that the Jordanians, in signing their pact, I think it was on the 30th of May 1967, a few days before the war broke out, the Jordanians signed the pact with Egypt, subordinating their army to the Egyptian military control. So he said later, I had no choice but to join the war because my army was actually under Egyptian control. Whether it was fully under Egyptian control or not is not clear. Mm-hmm. But that's what formally it was. Sure. And he did start shooting, and this led to Israel's conquest, unfortunately, of the West Bank, in my view, which has resulted in much of the problems we have today.
Although I can sympathize that for Hussein, that if Egypt and Syria would have won that war and the Jordanian army would have set out, all of his legitimacy, which I think was
He would have lost legitimacy because everybody suspected him in the Arab world of secretly parleying with the Israelis. There was intelligence exchanges, there was a Jordanian, Hussein was visited Israel a number of times, secret negotiations, secret talks. So they always suspected, and this was a result partly of Abdullah, his grandfather's dealings with the Zionists and with Israel pre-48 and in 1948 itself. Yeah. Even though Jordan went to war against Israel in 1948, there was a lot of goodwill between the Israeli authorities, the Jewish agency, and the Israeli government and the Jordanians, Abdullah. He didn't want war with the Jews, but he sort of felt forced into it, partly the same as Hussein, because he was part of an Arab coalition and felt that he would be considered a traitor if he stood aside.
And he was assassinated for that, essentially.
And he was assassinated for that and other things, but he was assassinated by a Palestinian gunman 3 years after the war, partly on the basis of allegations that he was secretly parleying with the Jews, which is true, of course.
Yeah. Yes. It seems kind of frustrating that a lot of the, I feel like a lot of the conflict sometimes in this area is brinksmanship. Do you think there's any truth, these are just random questions, I'm sorry, because I hear so many things talked about. Do you think there's any truth to the idea that there had been, so Israel had this reprisal policy, essentially, that if you do anything, if a bus gets hit by a mine, we're going to come back over and destroy.
Well, usually the reprisal policy was that a series of things happened.
Yeah.
That is, they attacked the bus, they attacked some woman in her kitchen, they did a number of things, and then Israel said, enough, and we send in a reprisal and attack.
Yeah.
That's usually how it happened. It wasn't usually a tit-for-tat, one-to-one basis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But do you think there's any truth to the idea that part of the reason why Egypt was expelling troops from the Sinai and mobilizing was because the Jordanian king Hussein was calling them out for doing nothing after Israel reprisals into the West Bank?
Okay, there was a particular reprisal, not a series or a policy, but in 1966, after a few terrorist incidents in which terrorists coming out of the West Bank attacked Israeli military, maybe also civilian targets, killing a few Israelis. Israel eventually launched a large-scale assault on Jordanian military positions and a village called Samoa in the southern West Bank, south of Hebron. And I think Israel killed more Jordanian soldiers in that attack than had been expected. Mm-hmm. And this was a big blow to Jordan. And the Jordanians accused the Egyptians, or at least the Jordanian press or Arab press, of the Egyptians didn't do anything about it. They hid behind the United Nations skirts. This was the phrase.
Yeah.
And therefore, that's one of the things which probably motivated Nasser a few months later in May 1967 to throw the United Nations force out of the Israel-Egyptian border, the buffer force which separated the Israelis from the Egyptians, which was one of the triggers to the 67 war. So in some way, the attack on Samoa, or if you like, the terrorist attacks which preceded the Israeli reprisal in Samoa, helped to launch the 67 war.
Something that we spoke to a Dr. Mordecai Kadar, and he has some very interesting opinions about the Middle East. Do you think there's any truth to the idea that the only successful countries that have emerged are basically ones that are modeled around these strong families that are essentially ruling these places, that the monarchs, the emirates, that when you try to make it like a state-based thing that doesn't have this kind of strong family monarch structure, that a state kind of falls apart, and that this might resemble Palestinian families having a lot of influence and strength, and then trying to thrust upon them like the Palestinian Authority isn't successful. Yeah, do you have any
questions? I'm not an expert on Arab sociology, but he has a point in that we're not talking so much about families as tribes.
Yeah.
He has a point that the more solid and apparently also successful to this day Arab states, the ones in Saudi Arabia, the Emirates, Kuwait, and even Jordan, are based on particular tribes or tribal alliances, meaning basically Bedouin tribes. Mm-hmm. And the more, if you like, modern Arab states, which have a hodgepodge of tribes, but also non-tribal urban populations like Egypt, Syria, and Iraq, are less stable, less successful. That's been the history of the place. So there's something in what he's saying, obviously, but it also depends on which region you're talking about. In a place like Egypt or Iraq, I don't think the tribal thing would work as well. There was certain tribalism also in Iraq, obviously, but it doesn't work as well because they're more heterogeneous states, mm-hmm. you know, Shiites, Kurds in Iraq, Sunnis, etc., whereas in Jordan, the tribes are all Sunni, and there are only a certain number of tribes which established the state of Jordan under Abdullah's aegis, basically. And the same applies to Saudi Arabia, the Emirates, and Kuwait. They had sparser populations and limited numbers of tribes which were able to work together ultimately.
Do you think that I have a lot of far right fans, very pro Zionist fans that watch me now after all my
Israel stuff. You call them far right?
Well, I shouldn't do that. I'm sorry. No.
How about liberal?
Liberal, sure. Well, right. It feels like you're far left and far right here.
Yeah, I'm joking. I'm joking.
One question, because I feel like we would disagree on this a ton, or that I didn't dig into this enough in my interview the first time. My impression is that this conflict feels like it's 85% driven by these like geographic tensions. Jews coming into the Middle East, and then these types of arguments basically over land, these fightings over land. And I feel like religion is like bubbling under the surface, like 15% of a driver. And they said that you would feel that the religious aspect is far more important than that.
Who said that?
I have fans not far right, very Zionist ones that say, Benny Morris says that religion is actually a huge deal here in the early. I feel like as of 2000 and onwards, especially with Hamas, that religion is starting to become more important with this Islamist idea. But prior to that, it feels more geographical.
I think you're underrating the importance of religion here.
Okay.
Firstly, the Hamas is the most popular party in the Arab, in the Palestinian world. Mm-hmm. They won the elections, the only general elections the Palestinians held, I think it was in 2006.
Sure. Just to reiterate, to be clear, from 2000 and onwards, I agree that the religious part has become very important. But a lot of
there was a lot of religious input also in the conflict mm-hmm. in previous decades. But it's true that it's gone up and down, the religious input as a motivating factor in the conflict. Mm-hmm. In 1929, for example, the major set of riots by Palestinian Arabs against Jews in Palestine, in which there was the famous Hebron massacre, the rallying cry of the Palestinians was the danger to Al-Aqsa, the same rallying cry which the Hamas has used on October 7th in 2023. Mm-hmm. So
can I ask a question? Let me add to that. Yeah,
religion, as Arab politicians have understood, certainly the Hamas has understood, religion plays an enormous part in Palestinian Arab life, probably in Arab life in general. They're not Norwegians. They're not Scandinavians. They don't. Religion is not unimportant to them. It's central to their identity, Islam. Mm-hmm. And in Palestine, they understood the leaders of the Palestinian national movement, especially Haj Amin al-Husseini, the major leader in the 30s and 40s of the Palestinian national cause, who was also a cleric, incidentally. He understood that you won't get the Palestinian masses, the urban masses or the rural masses, onto the streets against the Jews if you talk about Palestinian statehood or maybe a Zionist threat of a Jewish state being... you will get them onto the street if you start saying they're about to attack and destroy your sacred sites, your sacred Islamic religious sites. And that's how it worked in 29. The jihadist element in 67, in 48... which most historians neglected to look at, I think was important also in the, as a rallying cry in the Arab world in sending the various Arab armies to Palestine on the 15th of May 1948 in the Pan-Arab invasion. Jihadism was very important. We know that the Ulama of Al-Aqsa, of Al-Azhar University, which is the major university of Egypt and the most important, the most oldest university in the Arab world, and its theologians, the ulama of Al-Azhar, are seen as the respected theological determinants of God's will, if you like, or what's right for Islam. In the Sunni Arab world, which is the majority Muslim world, they, on the 1st of December, announced jihad, December 1947, as the civil war began in Palestine. They called for a worldwide Muslim jihad against the Jewish, emergent Jewish state, and reiterated this again in April 48 and then again in December 48. In other words, to get the Arab states to actually invade. So jihadism was there in the background.
Yeah.
We know that King Farouk told Western diplomats one of the reasons that Egypt invaded Palestine, Israel, in the 48 war was that he was afraid of the street, the Muslim street and the Muslim reaction against the Zionist enterprise, and that he had to abide by what the people, meaning the Muslim people, wanted him to do. So we know it's important, but sure. It's true that it's gone up and down as an element in the conflict, as a motivating element on the Arab side over the decades. Mm-hmm.
I guess I feel like there are some
and
aspects...
And now it's certainly at the forefront of the Arab attack on Israel.
One of the confusing things in sorting through the history here is people say things, and then people mean things, and then people do things, and sometimes all three of these things are different in terms of what they say, what they want, and what they actually do. And I guess if somebody were to tell me, for instance, this is why I feel this way about this, if somebody were to tell me that Zionism or a desire for Jews to have a country and a home in the Middle East was really important to Jewish people, I would see what the leaders are saying, then I would see what Israel's doing, and then I would see all of the Jews that, you know, made Aliyah to Israel. I was like, yeah, that seems to be true. I guess one of the interesting things is I always hear these speeches by Nasser and the talks about pan-Arabism and we're all together, and then I look at how all of these countries are constantly fighting each other over and fighting with each other, and then I look at, like, well, there were the calls to global jihad, but I feel like the feeling I have is that in 48, if there was truly a desire, a united desire, either of Arabs or of Muslims to destroy Israel, that it would have happened quite easily. That was the feeling that I had. But the inability to mobilize as many troops, the inability to do more than conquer some land, feels like it was there, but it was like paying lip service.
Just rhetoric, yeah. I think it's partly true what you're saying. Mm-hmm. I don't know if the Arab world was capable of mobilizing its potential power, mm-hmm, to destroy the Jewish state, but I don't think that desire was missing in 48. In other words, they had a desire, but they didn't have the tools and the ability to mobilize properly in 48. Mm-hmm. And they were reluctant to go to war, most of the leaders, because they knew they weren't really powerful enough to destroy the Jewish state, and feared in any case that the United Nations or the Americans or the Russians would intervene on behalf of the Jews. So this also
You think they would intervene?
I don't think so.
Oh,
the Arab world feared that they might.
Gotcha.
Because the Arab world kept telling themselves that the Jews in Washington and the Jews in Moscow are all supporting the governments there and forcing the governments to support the Jewish state. So they saw that there was a strong anti-Semitic feeling in the Arab world that the Jews are very powerful and are supported by the world community, and that the world community would save the Jews in 48, so maybe we shouldn't go to war against the Jews, though they did eventually go to war against the Jews. But there is a problem of a gap between rhetoric and actual actions in the Arab world, and this is true and has been true for many decades. They say certain things, but they don't necessarily mean them. The Christian leaders of Lebanon today speak against Israel, but they probably see Israel as potentially an ally of the Christians of Lebanon against the Muslims of Lebanon. Mm-hmm. But they can't say that because this will rile the Muslims and maybe cause civil war again in Lebanon. So there's always a gap between rhetoric and actual beliefs and even actions in the Arab world. There's a problem there.
And also
there's a gap between what they say publicly and what they may say privately, and what they say in public in English to American and British diplomats, and what they tell their people in Arabic. Mm-hmm.
The final final question. I know that historical counterfactuals are incredibly difficult. I guess another thing that I think of for that jihad, for that pan-Arab identity, do you think that if in 47, in November, December, because my understanding is in the beginning parts of that conflict, whether or not the Yishuv would survive was not as well known, especially as I think what it was like the cutoff of Jerusalem, all the shooting, the convoys that were being destroyed. If all of the Arab states would have come in at the end of 47 instead of waiting for...
They couldn't. Arab world couldn't have intervened. The Arab states around Palestine couldn't have intervened in the conflict because Britain was still the sovereign of Palestine
until
May 1948. They would have to fight the British forces, the Britain. They would have had a frontal clash with Britain had they invaded before the British left Palestine, before the end of the mandate. And that's why they waited. Not because they didn't want to join, but as I say, partly because they were afraid of clashing with the British, and the British made it clear to them, you can't invade so long as we are sovereigns of Palestine.
Okay. Well, hey, thank you. I really appreciate it. Thank you for answering my questions.
My pleasure.
Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Yeah? Oh, yeah. I'll ask one small question, okay?
Sure. Yeah.
Okay, we had an incredibly scholarly, informative debate with a guy named Finkelstein.
Two guys, Rabbani and Finkelstein. Yes.
The Rabbani guy was way worse, but he snuck by because of Finkelstein being crazy.
He was trickier than Finkelstein. Finkelstein comes across as a bit off off balance.
Yeah.
I don't know about off balance.
Sure. I'm just curious. This is a funny, random question. A lot of people have taken a clip of Finkelstein screaming at me, saying some other name, and you're laughing to the side of me.
Because it's so idiotic in a debate that some guy is trying to belittle his opponent by all sorts of accusations. This isn't how civilized debate should be conducted. So I thought it was sort of funny.
But okay, because a lot of people say that you're laughing at me.
No, not at all.
Okay. I was curious. Okay. Thank you. Yeah, cool. Thanks. Okay.